Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Front Stretch Podcast 2015 edition. We bring this edition of the podcast to you guys with heavy hearts, as last night we learned about the passing of IndyCar driver Justin Wilson. A terrible tragedy all around. For anyone who is not aware at this point, Wilson was struck by a piece of debris during the Pocono IndyCar race this past Sunday. And died as a result of those injuries. Joined by Mike Neff today, and we usually talk about NASCAR on this podcast, and we wanted to discuss some IndyCar on this podcast. We were something we were planning on doing now for a couple of weeks. It's unfortunate that this is the scenario that brought us to bring up the topic of IndyCar, but for the purposes of and the gravity of this news story, we're going to be talking about that today. For anyone that missed it at Bristol, Joey Logano won the race at Bristol, 500 laps, dominating performance by him, but that is the least of anyone's concern at this point. So, Mike, obviously, Justin Wilson's wreck is the number one issue in motorsports this week and today. First off, what are your thoughts on the crash? Could this have been prevented? Just general thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, my first general thought is obviously thoughts and prayers going out to Justin Wilson's family, friends, his fellow competitors, his teammates. I mean, racing is inherently dangerous, and part of what draws everybody to love that sport so much is the fact that it's not what it used to be as far as cheating death, but you're still cheating death every time you strap into one of those cars.
Yeah.
And the irony to me of this whole event is Justin died because of a technology that's designed to save drivers. The theory behind IndyCars hitting walls is that parts break off and shear away and dissipate energy, and that's how drivers avoid serious injuries and avoid death. And it's just really ironic to me that a piece that sheared off, designed to help Sage Karam, ended up taking Justin's life just in a fluke happenstance. I'm torn on this whole deal because I feel like the IndyCar folks are trying to make these cars go faster and get back up in that 230, 240 range, which we had given up on for a while. And somebody in the higher-ups seems to think that speed is what we really need. And that has resulted in these cars, I mean, not necessarily being harder to drive, but when they step out very far and you can't bring them back, the actions and the resulting calamity that goes with it seems far more intense than it needs to be. And I think that's the one thing that I hope we look at in hindsight or retrospect on this incident is that we reevaluate and decide that we don't need these cars doing 220, that they can put on just as good of a show at 180. But again, I'm very saddened. I hoped the fact that he had been airlifted and was still alive, although in a coma, was a positive scene. But it sounds to me like it was just some massive head trauma, and it may be that they just waited to get the family together. I don't know any of the particulars. I don't want to guess, but I'm glad to hear that his family was able to get there and at least say their goodbyes before his soul departed the earth.
Certainly, absolutely. Just top to bottom, it's such a tough situation. Obviously. First off, I want to personally send my condolences out to the Wilson family. Just so everyone knows, a trust fund was actually just set up for Justin Wilson's two children. And you can donate to that if you check out the IndyCar website. They have all the particulars set up for that. So please, if you get a chance, please do not hesitate to donate, because that'd be an amazing cause. As far as the incident itself, I think you bring up a very interesting point that I had not particularly considered about the speed. I don't offhand have the exact average speeds that they were averaging around Pocono this past weekend. I want to say they were in the 215 to 220 range. That being said, I do think that you bring up a very interesting point about chasing speed and what that results in for, auto racing. And chasing speed is it's a great thing, because chasing speed is what has made this sport what it is. And it's also what makes it so dangerous, because these cars are designed to break apart at certain speeds, just as they are to race at certain speeds. Like they always say in NASCAR, that one of the reasons why they keep the restrictor plates on the cars, and one of the reasons why they claim that they have the speed numbers that they want to keep the cars below, and by my knowledge, I believe the number is like 205 or something like that at Daytona Talladega. The reason why they have that number is because much of the safety equipment that NASCAR has implemented on terms of the cars, the tracks, the catch fences are designed to keep the cars intact under that speed. Once you go over that speed, it's kind of a crapshoot as to whether or not the cars will actually stay intact, or will at least stay intact in a way that they would be safe. So I think that's a very interesting point. I don't know if this was necessarily a case of them, I guess, chasing speed, because I don't know how much the speeds have actually gone up. I do know that as far as Pocono was concerned, the downforce levels were up this week at Pocono. I think part of that was due to the inability of cars to pass last year at Pocono. And I know that that was a factor, and they of them raising the downforce levels and made the race a little bit more competitive. I think the most important thing to note was that I don't think that this you can really pin the blame on any one particular thing. Like when we lost Weldon at Vegas, there were at least two or three different things that I think we could really pin the blame on, so to speak, beyond just obviously bad luck. In this case, I don't really know if there's one. I think this one really just came down to horrible timing, horrible place, wrong place at the wrong time. The one thing that did stick out to me, though, was the way that these aero kits break apart. Because the whole season, we've seen that these aero kits really just completely break into pieces when they have any sort of contact. And that's caused big problems at a lot of racetracks this year, where a car crashes and it's just a debris field throughout the whole track. And I don't think we've seen a debris field this season that was quite like the one that Karam's car ended up producing as a result of this wreck. And part of me cannot help but wonder if these aero kits are part of the reason why we saw such a debris field and potentially may have played a part in Wilson's incident. So what do you think about that? Because that was one thing that I did notice, and I don't know if that was a speed issue as much as perhaps it is an aero kit specific issue.
Yeah, and again, and I don't want this make to seem like we're trying to point blame at anything.
Of course, yeah, absolutely.
I truly feel like this was a fluke incident. I mean, the fact that that piece was in the right place as he came by and it caught him on a helmet. But I do agree with you that the aero kits are designed for speed. And so with that aero kit, that's part of the chasing of the speed that we got going on. But as far as I agree with you, when there seems to be more substance to the aero kit in general on these cars. So when they wreck and when they start breaking up, there's more mass to disperse. And so I think that is leading to some larger debris fields. And that may have been somewhat of a contributing factor. But again, it was a fluke thing that it worked out the way it did. I have multiple people message me to ask if I think that we ought to go to enclosed cockpits. And that's something that has been bandied about, I mean, back since the 80s probably, when we had some people all but decapitated racing in IndyCar. And from a safety standpoint, I'm all for it, because as we've seen, you know, people, Ayrton Senna had a suspension piece come in, is what killed him. I'm trying to remember who the other one was not that long ago that that was killed.
That was a Henry Surtees, I believe you were thinking about. He was a...
I was thinking there was one more in Formula One not too long ago that had a suspension piece go into the cockpit. And then
Well, that would be Felipe Massa. And that, is that who you're thinking of?
I was thinking it wasn't Kubica, although Kubica did get hurt by a piece of suspension. But the pieces going into the cockpit at the speeds that they're traveling are obviously a dangerous thing. And from that safety standpoint, I think enclosed cockpits are a great idea. We've even seen it coming about in drag racing. My worry from a competition standpoint is that the visibility out of those cars isn't that good to begin with. And unless it's a completely clear shield so that there's no further obstruction of view, I worry that it could have detrimental impact rather than the benefits of the safety. But it's curious. I mean, it's, again, we're going to pick this thing apart for weeks and months. I'm sure there will be some sort of a report and an investigation that ultimately decides what all went wrong and how they make it better. And as you said, we're never going to make open wheel safe. The fact that it's open wheel in and of itself makes it dangerous. And you try to make it as safe as possible, but it's auto racing. And I've been arguing this for stock cars as well. At some point you get stuff where you're trying to prevent all eventual possibilities from happening and hurting people to a point where it is a detriment to your sport. Yep. And I don't want to see us over-regulate open wheels so much that it makes the sport just not interesting.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's always been the classic problem, I guess you could say, or the debate in motorsports has always been, okay, we have one of the things that makes this sport so dangerous is also what makes it so interesting. And how do we reconcile those two things? I have to be honest, I think NASCAR's done a really good job over the past few years of balancing that out and maintaining that sense of danger without compromising the safety of the drivers. I really feel like IndyCar is in definitely a different scenario because the sport of IndyCar racing is so much more inherently dangerous than really any other sport I can think of on the planet. I can't think of too many other sports or sports leagues that have lost as many competitors during the course of competition as IndyCar has. It's the very nature of racing cars that have open cockpits, very little in the way of fenders or any sort of, how should you phrase this, any sort of material that prevents the driver from crashing the driver's body from the outside world. You know, in NASCAR, you have a huge car, fenders, a roll cage, all that. In IndyCar, you have a little pod, essentially, that they're sitting in, and the wheels are exposed, everything's exposed. They're going 220 plus miles per hour. There is almost no way to make that sport completely safe. That being said, I think it has come to the point where we need to start looking into ways to shield the driver's head from the outside world. And I think the only way to do that is some sort of a canopy or a closed cockpit. To be honest, I really don't know why we've been waiting so long for this. I guess you could say Wilson's incident is probably the most publicized, is probably going to end up being the most publicized incident where a driver had debris hit him right in the head, which is, I think, what everyone's always been fearing. And it really is very unfortunate that it has come to this, but I think there's really no option other than this at this point. The question I have for you is...
We've seen it for years. We know, I mean, head and neck restraints, for goodness sakes. We knew for 10 years that we needed to get those implemented and taken advantage of so that incidents like Greg Moore and Kenny Irwin and Adam Petty wouldn't happen. And it took a legend dying because of it before they actually pushed it forward. We've seen this for a while, but there's always been the excuse, well, his head hit the pole, but it was because the car was off the ground. It wasn't because his head was exposed. Or, you know, his brain ended up smeared on the track because he was upside down and it ground through the helmet, it wasn't because of something hitting it. Now you've got an instance where somebody was in a perfectly functioning race car that had not had any participation in the accident whatsoever that ultimately died because something hit him in the head. And there's no way to excuse anything around it other than to say he wouldn't have died if they had had an enclosed cockpit. So I'm hoping that this will be the impetus needed. But I'm sure there will be much grandstanding and debate until it finally happens.
I really do hope not, because it seems intuitively obvious to me what needs to be done in this case. I mean, we've been, like you said, it's very similar to the Hans device issue. We've known now for 10 years that I think we've been kind of been playing with fire. We have the technology to make closed cockpits. There have been prototypes designed with them. There is, in my opinion, no excuse at this point to keep using open cockpits. It's reckless at this point, and incidents like this are really only driving that home. This is such a different scenario than the Dan Weldon crash 4 years ago. With Weldon's crash, there was just so many different factors that could have led to that. In this case, it was just a really unfortunate, unfortunate accident. You know, in Weldon's case, there was a lot of different factors that could have been blamed, but there's really no, it was just horrible, unfortunate, bad luck for Justin Wilson that going forward is something that I think we can seriously avoid. I think if you take a look at what the World Endurance Challenge has done, the Tudor Sports Car Series, they all have made open or closed cockpits work on cars that traditionally were had open cockpits. So I really hope that this is the impetus that the sport needs for some sort of a change. And I'm very interested to see how the rest of the media does take this. Do you think that there is going to be a contingent in the, you know, mainstream media who all tends to only pick up on this sport when something like this does happen? Is IndyCar once again going to get blamed as reckless or negligent or something of that manner? Like, how would you compare this incident to the Weldon incident and how it's going to be perceived on a grander scale throughout the world?
Well, that's a good question. I got to feel like at least some people are going to question it, because let's face it, if he has something above his head, that piece doesn't hit him. So there's undoubtedly going to be people that are going to question it and, you know, why are we going there? But there's going to be, I mean, there's some level of tradition and history involved where you are adverse to that dramatic of a change to the sport. But as you've said, at some point you have to let that go and realize that safety in this situation is far more important. But yeah, you're probably right. I got to imagine Nancy Grace is going to be stumping and bringing it up, and calling for people's heads, not to make light of that, but we'll probably be pointing out that there should have been something. But the Weldon, like you said, the Weldon case was so different because it was, you know, the packs weren't broken up and people were upset about that. And then the incident happened and he was far enough back. Was there a delay in whether the yellow came on in the car? I mean, there was a multitude of things that went on that kind of built up to him having his incident. This thing, everything from what we can see, functioned the way it was supposed to function. Caution came out. Everybody was decelerating. The car did its thing and broke up so that Sage didn't get hurt. And it was a fluke. So, yeah, I have no doubt that some mainstream folks are going to jump on it. But I hope and I feel like if the IndyCar PR folks are in front of it the way they should be, they can explain most of it away as just a fluke happenstance that really couldn't have been planned for.
Yeah, I would have to agree. I think if anyone takes a look at this incident rationally, obviously it could have been avoided if there was a closed cockpit, but up to this point, that hasn't been what the sport has been about. Obviously, that will change. I have almost no doubt about that. But like I said, up until it was part of the fabric of the sport to have open cockpits. So I don't want to use the word acceptable because that's obviously not what I'm saying, but I think that there is going to be a bit of understanding when it comes to this particular incident as opposed to the Weldon incident. You're going to get ignorant folks, you know, on mainstream, you know, channels that don't understand the sport and are going to call for people's heads. But I think we need to step back and say that this really was just a horrible incident and a learning experience, I think, for all of us. It's really unfortunate that it had to be that way and that we had to lose an amazing man and an amazing driver in the process. But that is, I think, how this incident is going to go down. I think building on that, though, where do you think this leaves the sport of IndyCar racing? By all accounts, IndyCar has had, up until this particular weekend, which pretty much undid all of the good that IndyCar has done this year, IndyCar had a good season up until this particular point. Ratings were up almost every week. Attendance has been better at some tracks. The sport, it was generally considered to be throughout the industry on the upswing. And with an incident like this happening, where do you think this leaves the sport going forward? There were people after Weldon died who really thought that was going to be the end of IndyCar. I'm certainly not going to take it that far with this incident, but what do you think this is going to do to the sport going forward in all of those respects?
There's one piece that I hope happens, and it gets to the very, not really the foundation of the sport, but the current infrastructure of the sport, or the current skeleton of the sport, I guess you'd say. And that is people getting to that level solely because they bring money to the table.
Interesting.
And I think it's something that people that have the ability to make the decisions need to be held accountable for and need to take a serious look at how they make those decisions going forward. There's been a lot of chest thumping and stumping about people that don't deserve to necessarily be at that level, but they've brought money and that's why they've gotten the rides. And you can debate that all you want, but at this point, I truly believe that we need to reevaluate how people progress in the sport, and not just open wheel. I mean, open wheel is going to be the focus of it, and I think that's going to probably be the one that has the first bout with this. But I'm thinking just the sport in general, there needs to be more development time. And there needs to be almost requirements in the rules or requirements by the sanctioning body for proven success at the earlier levels. And it's funny to say that because if you look back at it, if you did that, Tony Stewart and Jimmy Johnson probably wouldn't be in the cup level because neither one of them was very successful at all in the Busch series. But I feel like when you're dealing with missiles on wheels that can turn around and bite you and bite other people, there needs to be a level of skill and expertise that has been proven before these people are jumping in there. And it shouldn't be solely on the fact that they or their friends or their dad or somebody can write a big enough check to get them in the seat.
Well, I think another thing that goes into that is when we're doing wide open styles of racing at places like Pocono, Indianapolis, Michigan, Fontana, Texas, there's been a debate about Texas over the years. Okay, should it be a wide open track? Should it be a track where you let off? People are always like, well, you know, you can flat foot it. That must mean it's easy. And with that, you know, it almost gives license to some of these pay drivers to come in and muck around, see this with restrictor plate racing too. I think that when you get an incident like this, or with something, or like an incident like Weldon, it makes you step back and say, okay, these guys that are, if we're going to be doing pack racing and stuff like this, if we're going to be having wide open styles of racing where the draft is important and it keeps the cars bunched up, you got to have guys in there that know what they're doing. It's absolutely imperative. I think you bring up a great point that I think that people throughout motorsports need to treat these styles of racing with a bit more respect from the sense of the danger and the skill that you actually do need to not crash. It's not enough to just be able to say, okay, I can flat foot it like the best guys and keep up. That doesn't necessarily mean that I can A, race against them, or B, race safely against them, and C, do what I need to do to avoid putting myself or anyone else in danger. And that's a question that I think all series, any series throughout the world that engages in that kind of racing is going to need to really ask themselves. I know that NASCAR has actually taken steps with that in the past. I know that if you do not have, I believe, at least one or two starts on a track 2 miles or larger without having any other starts anywhere else, you're not allowed to race at Daytona or Talladega. There's like a certain set of requirements that you have to meet to actually race at Daytona and Talladega and NASCAR, just because of how dangerous it is and how much skill you actually do need to not just hold it wide open, but to actually be able to race safely wide open and race competitively wide open, because those are two, all three really very different things, and those are three very different levels of expertise. And people don't like to admit this, but there's really only a handful of guys on this planet that can race safely that close. So I completely agree. I think that's something that we need to get in at least an IndyCar, because it doesn't seem like the vetting process has been that strong historically for the style of racing. So I guess my final question is, where does IndyCar go from here? Like, where is this going to lead the sport next week, and then going forward towards 2016? Do you see this hurting the sport overall, or do you see this being an opportunity to learn and something that the sport can build on going forward, so that they don't lose any momentum that they built over the past, couple of years in the wake of getting past the Weldon incident and everything else that they've dealt with? Obviously, the sport has been in a very up and down place over the past 10, 20 years since the split, and it looked like it was finally coming back. Like I said, do you see this being a derailment of sorts?
It's going to depend on how they handle it. There's positive PR, there's negative PR, there's different spins that are all going to be a part of this deal. And provided they embrace what has happened, obviously the next race will be an incredibly somber event. It's going to be very hard for a lot of people in the sport to even go out and function, just because when you have a situation like this occur, and face it, racing's family, and anytime anybody leaves the family, it shakes everybody up. So the next race will be very difficult for sure. But going into 2016, and that may be actually a good thing that it happened this late in the season. Going into 2016, provided they get a report and they show whatever it is they determine happened, and they come up with a specific plan to not only address this unique instance, but to lay out a plan going forward as to how they want to shape the sport. I think they could actually grow it because of this incident. But if they don't do that, and they just slap some different aero packages on them going to 2016, and they go back after it without really explaining what happened and how they're trying to fix it, then absolutely it'll be a blow, and it'll probably take them another 3 to 5 years to recover from it again. So they've got some options, and I'm hoping they will be transparent enough to get out there and tell us exactly what happened and come up with at least some kind of an idea or a plan to prevent it from happening in the future.
Certainly. Certainly. And, as a motorsports community, I think we'll all look at this as a learning experience, and we'll, like we always have, we'll move on, we'll keep racing, because that's what we do, and that's what this sport has always done, and we'll just have to keep moving forward and try to make the sport safer, because that's all we can really do in the case of this. Folks, we thank you for listening on what's been a very tough episode to do for both myself and Mike. Please tune in 2 weeks from now, because we will be taking a week off next week for the NASCAR off week. And join us as we return to our NASCAR coverage for the Darlington race. I'm signing off for Mike Neff. This is Matt Stalnick. And we want to wish one more time condolences to go out to the Justin Wilson's family and everyone associated with the IndyCar community. Thank you.
Godspeed, JW.